with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
The reproductive lifespan of women in the United States has increased over the past six decades, according to a recent study from Texas Tech University. We'll talk with the author who says that increase produces benefits and risks to much more than just a woman's reproductive health. Then, according to the National Cancer Institute, there are nearly 17 million cancer survivors in the U.S., each with a different experience. On this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, we'll learn about the unique needs and concerns of cancer survivors of all ages. And we all face everyday stress. We'll talk with a neuropsychologist for advice on how to recognize stress and find relief. That's all straight ahead on this week's Med Clinic Radio.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
How many years will a woman be most able to have children? Researchers at Texas Tech University wanted to find out if women's so-called reproductive lifespans were increasing, decreasing, or staying the same. And if it was changing, what was driving that? Reproductive lifespan appears to affect women's health in matters not even related to reproduction, but more study is needed to fully understand that. Joining us now is Duke Appiah, Assistant Professor in the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences. He led this recent research with findings published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Professor, your study looked at when women began their menstrual cycles and when they reached menopause, their reproductive lifespan. What did you learn about the lifespan's length, and what data points did you use to calculate that?
For calculating reproductive lifespan, we subtracted the age and natural menopause from the age and menarche, age and menopause being the time a woman stops menstruating, and age and menarche being the time a girl or a young woman will start menstruating. And so the difference between those two ages give us an idea of the reproductive lifespan, that is, the time in which a woman potentially can give birth.
And a longer reproductive lifespan on average, which is, I believe, what you found, means that a woman's body is producing estrogen throughout that longer period of time. Now, there are benefits and risks. First, Professor, what appear to be the benefits of exposure to this estrogen?
The benefits of being exposed to longer years of estrogen definitely has to deal with cardiovascular disease, whereby most research, especially in the basic sciences, have shown that estrogen to be cardioprotective in preventing cardiovascular diseases. So in that sense, it helps us to, in a way, prevent cardiovascular disease. So the longer, the better for cardiovascular disease.
And also osteoporosis?
Definitely.
And to some extent, what about cancer?
For some cancers, yes, but then others, not so much. So, for instance, even though you have even though you are preventing, let's say, cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis, it's also associated with something like breast cancer. So you are reducing one thing and you are also increasing something else, but it's not conclusive. So that's what current evidence is showing. But with more studies, maybe we can tease out how all these mechanisms work.
Your results indicated race, economic status, and some other factors were apparently associated with when women reached menopause. Is that right?
Yes. So factors like, for instance, with race, women who were considered like Blacks, African American, and women of Hispanic ancestry were found to reach menopause at an earlier age compared to women who were non-Hispanic whites.
And how about smokers? A thing there that might be connected?
Definitely. So with the smokers, it's not mainly new. Like most research have shown that people who smoke cigarettes, current or even former smokers, reach menopause at an earlier age, sometimes 1 or 2 years earlier than women who do not smoke at all.
And you also mentioned that hormone therapy use was associated with earlier age at natural menopause. What are we talking about there, birth control?
When I talked about the hormone therapy, I'm talking more about hormone therapy for preventing menopausal symptoms like hot flash. So normally that one excludes like oral contraceptive use or birth controls, but that one is mainly for trying to help a woman go through menopause in a better way compared to if they didn't have hormone therapy.
And now what factors did you tend to see for the reverse, women who had a longer reproductive lifespan? What factors were associated with that?
They were mainly oral contraceptive use, which is also birth control, and most importantly, education. So women who tended to be more educated tended to have longer reproductive lifespan compared to those who were less educated.
We're visiting with Duke Appiah, assistant professor in the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, about a study of women's reproductive lifespan and what effect that can have on her general health. Overall average 2-year increase in the reproductive lifespan that you found, would you characterize that as a significant increase?
I would definitely say yes. If you are considering that it just takes like 9 months to give birth in most situations, then it's significant. Increasing from 35 years to 37.5 years, I would say is quite significant.
Could results such as yours here lead to interventions that actually improve a woman's general health? And if so, could you give us an example or two?
Definitely. The thing about this research and most of my research is that I'm always trying to draw our attention to implementing preventive measures earlier. So, for instance, adopting lifestyle factors earlier in a woman's age will have several benefits. So, for instance, even though we didn't really look much at obesity in this study, most studies have seen that women who tend to be obese tend to also have other risk factors like hypertension, which will influence the time of reaching natural menopause. So if interventions are implemented earlier, then it will also help a woman to have a longer reproductive lifespan. Another thing I want to draw our attention to is that because reproductive lifespan is made up of both age and menarche and age and menopause, we also need to take into consideration the age and menarche, which also reduced considerably from 13.5 years on average to 12.7 years. And when a young lady starts menstruating early, some studies have also seen that it's associated with other cardiometabolic conditions or adverse cardiometabolic conditions leading to diabetes as well. So even though we have a longer reproductive lifespan, which is a great thing, we also have to also implement some of these risk factor reductions, which could lead to disease.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about this recent research into women's time frames for being able to bear children. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Texas Tech Assistant Professor Duke Appiah, whose team studied the changing reproductive lifespans of American women over the past 60 years. Professor, let's drill down on the study itself. Your team analyzed more than 7,700 women. What were their ages, and tell us, were any women excluded?
The age range that we used was 40 to 62. We excluded women who reported having natural menopause beyond 62 because such are likely to be associated with other pathological conditions. And also we wanted to actually picture more of the natural process of menopause, because menopause, which occurs beyond before age 40, is termed as premature menopause, which is also associated with other underlying factors. So we wanted to exclude women who could have reached menopause by some of these underlying conditions which influences natural menopause. We also excluded women who reach surgical menopause because we still wanted to look at the natural phenomenon. And also we excluded women who reported even natural menopause due to other reasons. For instance, let's say undergoing a chemotherapy.
And your study is an important update, isn't it? I see that a previous study used data back to 1910?
Yes, but the difference between this one and the other study was mainly consisted of studies which were done in a few states, whilst this one is a sample which represents the United States. So we use data from the National Health and Nutritional Examination Survey, which like began in 1959, but it gives us a naturally representative sample of the U.S. population compared to the previous one, which was a great study, but it wasn't a naturally representative sample of women in the United States.
So you actually used successive surveys spanning from the 1959 to 62 National Health Examination Survey 1.
Yes.
Through the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey for 2017 through 18. Now, that second one, wasn't that especially helpful in filling in some of the blanks of the women's health and life situations?
I would say so, because if you take that study into consideration, as I told you, it wasn't a naturally representative sample, then it means that for over 100 years, we haven't had a natural, like information from naturally representative sample of American women. So I believe this fills a great void which was there. And now we at least have an idea of the average age whereby a woman reached natural menopause in the United States. Previously, it has been postulated, or some studies have cited other smaller studies, for it to be age 51 years. However, this naturally representative sample gives us an idea that the average age at which menopause occurs in the U.S. is 50 years, a little bit behind those in Europe, but at least we have some data that represents all women in the United States.
And even beyond the data you just mentioned, there was a behavioral questionnaire, was there not? A physical examination? There were a lot of additional pieces of information you were able to get, weren't there?
Yes. So I'll always praise the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey because it's unique. It's one of a kind in the world. Other countries are trying their best to replicate some of it, which is a great testament to how good it is. And it comprises of like medical examination, questionnaire, which asks several questions beyond even reproductive factors. It asks questions on smoking. It asks questions on mental health and several aspects of it. There's also a lab component whereby we actually, the investigators or like CDC actually measures biochemical markers. So for instance, C-reactive protein, glucose level, fasting glucose level, cholesterol, and several others. So I think it's one of the most comprehensive national surveys out there. And the unique thing about it, even though I didn't use it in my study, is there is a mortality follow-up as well.
So Professor, let's speculate. Could the longer reproductive lifespan be due to better health care for women than in past decades?
We could. Some studies in other countries have actually assessed that, and they have realized that having access to good health care actually improves a person's lifestyle, which also improves the time at which they reach natural menopause. Interesting enough, like in our study, we also look at poverty index, which is a measure of poverty, and women who tended to have a lower index, that is to say they were poor, tended to reach natural menopause at an earlier age. So as we increase access to health and also improve the health care that women actually receive, I believe it also impacts the reproductive lifespan that they have.
We've been talking with Duke Appiah, assistant professor in the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center, Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences. He led a recent research program on trends childbearing years. We focused on the average age of women's reproductive lifespan increasing, but some women, as you point out, still reach menopause earlier than the norm. And you say it's not so important about the age itself, but what factors are causing that? Can you explain?
So the age is important in a way, but once you reach, there's not much to do. However, like as I mentioned, if we improve some of the factors that we know which are associated with reaching menopause at an earlier age, then we can extend it. So for instance, let's talk about smoking. So as this study showed, like women who were current smokers reached menopause at an earlier age compared to even women who were former smokers. So, for instance, even dropping, let's say, or cutting down on cigarette smoking can enhance the time at which a woman reaches natural menopause. And the timing itself, several studies show that it's associated with several conditions like cardiovascular disease and even cancers as well. So my message is, like, if we can reduce some of these factors which are adversely associated or factors which cause a woman to reach menopause at an earlier age, then we can actually improve their health and their well-being and their quality of life during the postmenopausal years.
Professor, some experts say that reproductive health is like a sixth vital sign for human wellness. Do you agree with that?
I'll have to agree. I'll have to. Based on my research, I'll have to agree.
As we look to the future, then, you are interested in age and menopause and how that's associated with changes in the heart. Tell us about what changes in the heart you'd be looking at.
Some of my research and some which are currently undergoing shows that women who reach menopause at an earlier age tend to have a larger heart, which you would say enlarged left ventricle or higher left ventricular mass, and also how the heart beats and relax. So that's the contractility and relaxation. So when we look at women who reach menopause at an earlier age, even before age 50, we see that they tend to have larger left ventricles and as well as impairment in the relaxation and contractility of the heart.
I want to wish you a lot of luck on those future studies. Texas Tech Assistant Professor Duke Appia, whose team studied the changing reproductive lifespans of American women. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I'd like to also thank my co-authors who work with me on this paper. They did a tremendous job.
Thank you. Up next on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, the aftermath of cancer treatment is as unique as each cancer survivor. We'll hear from a Mayo Clinic expert to learn how doctors address the needs and concerns of cancer survivors. Stay with us. MedClinic Radio continues in a moment.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Streed. If one member of a family has celiac disease, there is a likelihood other members will be affected as well, says Dr. Joseph Murray.
Family members who have somebody in the family with celiac disease are much more likely to have celiac disease than the general population.
Gluten is a protein in wheat, barley, and rye, and it can cause damage in the intestine for those with celiac disease. Common symptoms include
abdominal pain, diarrhea, bloating, excess gas, fatigue, anemia.
Dr. Murray says because of the genetic component, family members should consider being screened.
You can do a blood test, and the blood test, if it's positive, indicates a likelihood of celiac disease.
Avoiding gluten is the only treatment. If you have symptoms and think you might have celiac disease, Dr. Murray says to get tested before changing your diet. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Now, on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A, a look at how and why cancer survivors' needs are unique for each patient. Here's Mayo Clinic's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
According to the National Cancer Institute, there are nearly 17 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and each one of them experiences cancer survivorship differently. Some are living with cancer, some are cured of their cancer, and some are suffering from long-term side effects of the treatment of their cancer. Joining us today to discuss cancer survivorship is medical oncologist Dr. Catherine Ruddy. Dr. Ruddy is the Associate Director of Patient and Community Education and co-chair of the Symptom Control Survivorship Cross-Disciplinary Group at the Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. Thank you so much for being here. I find this topic fascinating because I think we think so much about treatment of cancer, but we don't necessarily think a lot about what happens after people have treatment for their cancer. And how wonderful that so many people are being cured or surviving such that this is a hot topic. Can you tell us how you define cancer survivorship?
Well, it's interesting. I think some people do think of survivorship as starting after cancer treatment, as you kind of alluded to. But I tend to think of it as actually starting kind of at the diagnosis of cancer and then going on through the rest of life. So for lots of people, that means the time during treatment and then after treatment. For some people who need indefinite treatment for their cancer, it means that they're always getting some type of treatment, but the survivorship periods kind of goes on throughout that.
So, Katie, what is important about cancer survivorship? What kind of physical and emotional needs do patients and individuals have after a cancer diagnosis?
Well, it differs a lot from person to person, as you'd imagine, related to the fact that people are getting all different types of treatments that have different side effects. Some of the very common issues that cancer survivors deal with include fatigue, because lots of our different types of treatments can cause that. Distress, the anxiety and emotional distress of dealing with the diagnosis and with the ongoing therapies for some people can be really significant. And even transitioning out of treatment can be a distressing experience. There can be issues related to finances. The financial stress related to loss of work or medical costs can be significant. And then there are also physical side effects, things like numbness and tingling of the hands and feet for people who get chemotherapy that can cause that. So it's really a wide variety of issues that can happen.
What other kind of medical care do individuals need after a diagnosis of cancer or even after their treatment is completed?
Our social workers and psychologists provide a really important type of care for our patients. It is just, as I mentioned, such a stressful experience that we try to engage our social workers and psychologists often and really offer that to all patients. And not everyone wants to take advantage of that, but that's certainly a key piece of care for a lot of people. Physical medicine and rehab to help with physical dysfunction, fatigue, that's very important. As you mentioned, pain is a very common side effect, both the related to the chemotherapy, but also to all sorts of other parts of cancer treatment, including surgeries and radiation. And so pain management is very important. It's really a very multidisciplinary practice that we bring to caring for our cancer survivors.
You mentioned pain, but what are some of the long-term physical side effects that are left after cancer at times?
Well, it's so different from person to person. I'm a breast oncologist. So one of the symptoms that my patients often are dealing with is hot flashes. And of course, many women have hot flashes when we go through natural menopause, but breast cancer treatments can make that worse. Sometimes women go through menopause at an earlier age and more rapidly because of breast cancer treatments. And our women's health clinic provides really important care to help people manage, reduce the amount of hot flash burden. Hot flashes can interfere with sleep, and insomnia can be a really, really big problem, both related to hot flashes and otherwise. And so we have a sleep clinic here, but we also have people in the women's health clinic who help with reducing the night sweats and hot flashes that for some people are a really big problem overnight.
I think one of the key things that I got out of what you just said is that if people have side effects, they should ask about them because there may be solutions for them. I think sometimes we think, well, you know, an individual might think I've had cancer, I've had treatments, so this is to be expected. I should just be grateful for what I have. But I think knowing that there may be symptom management available is really important.
Absolutely. It's really important to talk to your providers about these symptoms, about any symptoms that you're having. But there are things that can be done. Dr. Chabille, who's one of the PM&R doctors, the rehab doctors here at Mayo Clinic Rochester, has a huge project right now ongoing to assess symptoms prior to every medical oncology visit in Rochester and also through the Midwest Health System. And this is really important. It's an incredible step forward because it is encouraging us to communicate about these symptoms even prior to visits. And as part of her study, she has nurse symptom care managers involved to help us better address certain symptoms. Now, that project doesn't address every symptom, but I hope it will get people talking more to their oncologists about all sorts of types of symptoms so that we can offer the best treatments we can.
That's great. Awareness is important. In the intro, Katie, I mentioned that there are children surviving cancer as well, and I imagine that they and their families have very unique needs. What would some of those be?
Well, you're absolutely right. For one thing, the cancers that afflict children are quite distinct from those that are common in adults. So treatments and expected long-term symptoms are not the same. And I'm not a pediatric oncologist. So in my practice, I'm not seeing children or childhood survivors. I do see adolescent and young adult survivors. breast cancer is one of the common cancers in young women. And we usually define adolescent and young adult as actually going up to age 40. So we do have many young women in our clinic who actually can experience more severe side effects sometimes due to our breast cancer treatments because of the sudden menopause. You know, going into menopause at age 30, or at least your body feeling like it's in menopause at age 30, comes with some pretty severe side effects at times, bad vaginal dryness, sexual dysfunction, things that if you went into menopause at your normal age at 50 or 55 at an average age, would come on more gradually and potentially be less of a burdensome symptom. So in terms of actual children and teenagers who are having cancer and who are surviving, of course, there are all sorts of a wide variety of symptoms that can happen. And really, the experience of cancer is often both very difficult for the children, but also for their parents. And lots of supports are needed to help manage those.
So tell us a little bit more about some of the unique things that Mayo Clinic is doing to help care for cancer survivors.
Well, we in Mayo Clinic Rochester, we've had this wonderful cancer education center, the SLAGI Center, for years. And there are also wonderful educational offerings at our other sites in Florida and Arizona and health system. Right now, what we're working to do is to really bring all of that together under a new education committee that will allow patients across the whole Mayo enterprise and even outside of Mayo to access these resources virtually. But I think one thing that the pandemic has really helped to move forward is our figuring out how we can get these resources out to people, make them accessible, even for patients who are living 10 hours away from here or who are at who are being seen at other sites, for people to be able to get the information that they need about symptom management, about surveillance, about psychosocial supports. And that's really, I think, an exciting effort. We also have Mayo Clinic Connect, which is a social media connectivity for patients to find others who might be experiencing similar things and to have conversations virtually and to get support through a moderated platform. So these are things I'm really excited about, and I think we'll see continue to grow over the years to come.
Katie, supposing that an individual is nearing the end of their cancer treatment, what questions should they ask their doctor at some of their later appointments to prepare them for what things will look like in the future and what they should be watching for?
Well, I think some of the important questions are, of course, what kind of care is going to be needed? You know, when do I need to come back? Who do I need to see? What kind of testing will I need, or if any? But then also lifestyle-wise, what can I do in between those visits, whether that's medications I can take or not take, or exercise or diet? Are there things I can do to help me feel better or have a better outcome in various ways? Those are the conversations I think are really optimally, we should be having those throughout the cancer journey, both from the time of diagnosis, but at the end of treatment is a nice time to kind of have those conversations again and to help with the transition out of a more frequent visit schedule into something that's probably going to be, patients are coming back less frequently. It's nice to kind of talk about, okay, what can I do at home and when do I need to come back?
I think that would help a lot with uncertainty if people have a plan in place. That's always good. Knowledge is important.
Yes. I don't know if you've heard about survivorship care plans, which are kind of refer to a document that summarize all of that. And survivorship care plans are great. We love when we can get when we can provide those to patients, but there's also just a real value to that conversation and talking it through. And of course, sometimes all the visits can be very overwhelming. So people should feel free to reach out again to clinicians if they're confused or can't remember what was said, or, you know, sometimes it's hard to absorb and retain all that information at once.
Okay, do we talk a lot about clinical trials for cancer and ongoing treatment for patients and various disease states? What about cancer survivors? Are we doing research at Mayo Clinic on and with cancer survivors?
We are. Well, I mentioned Dr. Chaville's really phenomenal symptom management study, which is called E2C2. That's actually funded by the National Institute of Health, and it's part of a much larger effort to better assess and manage symptoms across the country. And the symptoms I should mention on that study, the specific symptoms that are being addressed are insomnia, pain, anxiety, depression, fatigue, and physical dysfunction. So it's kind of six specific things. It doesn't cover everything. It doesn't, for example, specifically address numbness and tingling. But it's hard for any one study to cover every symptom. It does cover what we think are the very common symptoms that can occur across really all cancers and across all types of treatment. And that's how this was developed. But there are other studies too that are a little more focused, you know, focusing in clinical trials, sometimes focus on a particular medication or a particular type of exercise. And those are varied across the enterprise. Dr. Chaville's study is the largest study I'm aware of that's currently ongoing, that's both in Mayo, Rochester, and across the entire health system.
You know, we're talking so much about healthcare disparities, and we've talked about virtual medicine as a way to be able to provide some equity and provide care in areas and to individuals who might not be able to readily receive it. Are there healthcare disparities related to cancer survivorship that we should be aware of?
Yeah, unfortunately, there are. And this is an area of research and growing research. We really want to do better with reducing these disparities. Some of the issues are related to geographical and financial barriers to care. Anything that makes it difficult to access healthcare can contribute to inferior outcomes for patients. And so it's important that we work hard to minimize these barriers. You know, here at Mayo Clinic Rochester, one of the issues is we're hard to get to for a lot of people. So figuring out what we can provide virtually, as we talked about earlier, how can we get our resources out and available to people who maybe live afar or have other barriers to getting here is part of what I think we're making progress on, but we need continued work on.
Thanks for being here today, Katie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our thanks to medical oncologist Dr. Catherine Ruddy for joining us today to talk about cancer survivorship.
Mayo Clinic Q&A is a production of the Mayo Clinic News Network and is available wherever you find your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org and then click on Podcasts. Coming up in a moment, are you stressed out? We'll hear from a leading neuropsychologist for some helpful advice on stress relief. That's next on MedClinic Radio.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Anyone with poor sleep, problems with their stomach, or even shallow breathing might be in the clutches of stress. But now, a neuropsychologist is out with a new book that has strategies for understanding and combating stress. Joining us now is Dr. Amy Sarin, author of The Stress Switch, The Truth About Stress and How to Short-Circuit It. Can we say that much of our stress may be unreasonable expectations that we put on ourselves, such as we should be earning more by now, or a child who thinks she or he has to make straight A's all the time?
Sure. I mean, certainly how we go about with our belief systems can fuel stress. But stress is actually your brain and body's moment-to-moment fluctuation based on sensory information coming in. And so we want to change those long-held beliefs if they're too perfectionistic. But what we also want to do is manage our stress when it goes too high. In other words, when your stress switch turns up, it might not have anything to do with your beliefs. It actually oftentimes is due to things that are outside of your awareness and outside of your control.
Or even some stimuli, like too much social media. Is that a major driver in causing stress, particularly for young people?
Yeah, social media can trigger insecurities and negative beliefs and things like depression and anxiety. And even things like a loud sound can also. So I think that in our current world, we're really obsessed with kind of consciousness and thinking that it's our beliefs that shape our stress. But really, a lot of times, there's a two-way street there. So we want to do behaviors like get off of social media, you know, if it's more than moderation or if it's fueling insecurities, maybe take a look at those insecurities and have a healthier view of yourself. But we also want to understand how stress really works in the body and know that it's just going to fluctuate without your awareness. So most of the time we can be walking around moderately stressed and we're not even aware that that's happening to us.
Your book mentions certain thinking habits that are harmful. Let's just take a few, one at a time. First, filtering information so we're not taking the whole picture into account. What's that?
So if we're in a negative state and someone gives us feedback, let's say at work, and says, you know, your work performance is really great, we're going to give you a 3% raise, but, you know, here are the areas you want to improve. So if we're stressed out, we are going to filter out the positive and focus on the negative, and that is going to fuel more stress. So we want to really take more of an objective look at what's happening around us and realize that our brain filters things out for us based on the mood that we're coming in with or based on how high our stress switch is when things happen. And then people know this. When they're stressed out, they catastrophize and make a big deal of things. And then when they calm down, they realize that it wasn't really so bad. And that's how filtering can get us into trouble.
And catastrophizing, as you just mentioned, that's sort of looking at the worst case scenario, isn't it?
Yeah. So filtering is kind of a precursor to that catastrophic thinking where you say, oh, no, they said I need to make all these improvements. And then a catastrophic thought would be, now maybe they're going to fire me. And then with thinking about that possibility, then turns the stress switch on high. And so these, what we call cognitive distortions that you're talking about and ways of thinking, these actually fuel our stress switch quite a bit, and they work in concert with one another.
Let's take just two more. One is overgeneralization. Explain that for us.
Overgeneralization is when we take an isolated incident and then we kind of think that it's going to apply to all incidences, or we overgeneralize. So if somebody says, you know, I was really unhappy that you said that, and you think that they're unhappy with you in general, or you think that they're always going to be unhappy with you, that's taking something very isolated and kind of blowing it up to a more general, bigger proportion, and then that's going to increase your stress.
Emotional reasoning, what's an example of that?
Emotional reasoning is when you have an emotion about something, and so then you feel like it's justified. So if I walk into a place and I get kind of a weird feeling for some reason, and I think, oh, it's because something really bad happened here, or something bad is going to happen because I have a feeling. That's what emotional reasoning is, using kind of your emotions to feel justified, or, oh, I felt really angry about that, therefore this person really is awful, terrible, or whatever. And it's using, instead of looking at our emotions for what they are, because they're just going to fluctuate sometimes based on other circumstances, we're always trying to kind of pinpoint why something is happening. And a lot of times we're wrong. And a lot of times it just fuels our stress switch, and it's unnecessary, and it gets us into trouble.
We're visiting with Dr. Amy Seren, author of The Stress Switch, The Truth About Stress and How to Short-Circuit It. You mentioned one approach to switching off stress is so-called bilateral stimulation, stimulating the body's left and then right and then back again repeatedly as we consider traumatic events of the past. How does that fix us?
Stress is actually a nervous system reaction in the moment, and it can be a reaction to a thought. So if you've had a traumatic experience, but you're sitting in a very safe room right now, you can still feel that trauma and your heart can race. And this is what happens in just normal stress or PTSD. And if we use this technique of bilateral stimulation while you're recalling an event, it actually changes the nervous system reaction to it. And this is how we cure PTSD. And this is how anyone at any time can actually have access to stress relief. So, you know, if your boss is having that conversation with you where you're tending to do those cognitive distortions, you can put the technology on even outside of a therapy session and it'll calm you down and you'll just naturally start thinking rationally. Because a lot of times we can't force rational thoughts if we're stressed out. So this technology works in concert with some of these other methods that you've been taught, but you can't really do those methods in the moment that you need them because you're too stressed out. So this kind of brings the body back online, and it allows you to take deep breaths, think more clearly, recognize, you know, a more reasonable stance on something. We all know how to rearrange our thinking and to breathe and all of that. But the problem, and what no one tells you, is that when your stress switch is too high, those parts of your brain is shut down and you can't access that. So we need access to that first to be able to use it.
Many of us know that relaxation is good for us. It's a good elixir for combating stress. But a lot of people say, I don't have time. I'm so busy. But do you recommend that your patients actually schedule time to relax, put it that high on their list of important things to do?
Absolutely. And what I don't do, though, is if I have a patient who is trying to relax and can't, they'll just get more stressed out. So we need to create the conditions where relaxation can happen and reset people's mindsets to understand that meditation, relaxation, things like exercise are the most productive things that you can be doing in a specific moment rather than answering 10 more emails or running this. And when we really look at people's list of have-tos, I guarantee you that in your life, you know, 10 to 20% of the things that you think you absolutely have to do that are cluttering up your life are not really have-tos. They're want to's, and you've convinced yourself that things either have to be a certain way or you have to run around or you have to do this or that. But really, when we break it down to simplifying your life and still being productive and healthy and happy, there's a lot that we can take off of our plate.
Dr. Amy Sarin, neuropsychologist who specializes in stress reduction, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for this week's MedClinic Radio, produced by Syndication Networks of Chicago. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week for more MedClinic Radio. Syndication Network.